This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Well, good morning, everybody. My name's Ian Gibbons and I'm a neuroscientist from Flinders University. And we've got, first of all, I'd like to say there's two really great things about this morning. First of all, we've got Mandayam Srinivasan, known as Srini, here to talk to us. And secondly, we've got a fantastic audience on a cold Sunday morning, which is great. I'll just say a few words for introduction for Srini. He's got an original background in engineering, electrical engineering, and then engineering and applied science at Yale University. But then he sort of made a switch, maybe a subtle switch, maybe a big switch, maybe we'll talk about that, into looking at neuroscience, how nerves work, how the brain works, potentially how the mind works, but not in people, but in bees. And Srini is extremely well known in the neuroscientific community in Australia, internationally, for his work on bees. He's also been well publicised through the media, through the television shows like Quantum and Compass, its precursor, and ABC. Srini himself has been recognised by his peers and by the scientific community for his contributions to neuroscience. He's published extensively in absolutely the very best scientific journals in the world, not just those which specialise in neuroscience, but which do all of science, journals like Science and Nature, which is... That's a real pinnacle of what you can do as a scientist. And he's been recognised with fellowships to the Australian Academy of Science and the Royal Society of London. And this is like getting a knighthood in science. It's sort of like Sir Srini of the bees in the scientific sort of context. And most recently, in 2006, he got the Australian Prime Minister's Science Prize, which is, again, a great recognition of his general contributions. Well, there's just a couple of things I'd just like to say about, I'm sure he's going to tell us why bees, but as someone who doesn't work on bees but who works on the nervous system, there's some really key things, and the basic biology of all animals is pretty much the same when it comes to the crunch. You can see how the individual cells work. It's all the same bits and pieces working in there, but just put together in a slightly different way. And even more recently, I suppose over the last 20 years, it's even been realised that the way things are put together, the rules that are used to put things together, are not that much different between any sort of animal. And so maybe when Srini started, it might have been a bit of a long shot saying that looking at bees was going to have something to do with understanding our consciousness, our intelligence. We think by the time it's finished, you will see that it's not that long a path at all. The other thing which Srini's work has shown us is how pure research can quickly and easily develop into unexpected practical spin-offs. So I'm sure he's going to tell you something about some of that today in terms of engineering, in this case, different ways of looking at how you can make novel practical applications. And the final point I'd like to make is, I suppose, taking advantage of being the chair for a minute, is that his sort of work, working on bees, is and the way it's moved into all sorts of other areas of interest, is the perfect retort or antidote for some of those sort of characters who seem to be overrepresented in politics, who'd say if you looked at a grant application looking something to do with what? The brain of bees? Why are we wasting taxpayers' money on something as arcane and as silly as that? As you'll see by the end of Srini's talk, it's not arcane, it's not silly. Apart from anything else, it's fascinating, and it's going to have all sorts of practical spin-offs. So with great pleasure, I'd like to welcome Srini to come and give us a talk about the milligram brain of a bee.
Thank you, Ian, for that very kind introduction. It is a tremendous pleasure and a tremendous honour to be speaking in front of you folks today. Thank you so much for coming. So that's the title of today's talk, Pushing the Limits of a 1 Milligram Brain. We're going to be looking at vision and perception and cognition of honeybees and possibly some applications to new ways of maybe designing flying vehicles, vision systems for flying vehicles anyway. So, well, you know, any one of you who's maybe tried to, swat a fly or watch a fly do a lovely beautiful landing on the rim of your teacup, or marveled at the honeybees heading out from its hive, traveling several kilometers in search of food. It's a meandering route that it does because it doesn't know where to find the food. But when it finds the food, which might be as much as many as 6 or 7 kilometers away, it'll make a beeline back home, literally. And the question is, how do they do this? How do they do this? A brain that weighs about the size of a milligram carries far fewer neurons than our own brains. By the way, can you hear me all right? Can you hear me clearly? Loud enough? And what is it that makes them tick and tick so well? So as curious scientists, as curious zoologists, one of the missions in our lab is to try and work out exactly what it is that makes these animals tick and tick so well. The other driving force, because as Ian mentioned, I was trained as an engineer initially, is if we do find something neat and clever that these creatures do, can we put them into... can we devise novel kinds of algorithms for vision that we can put into flying vehicles that will one day hopefully fly autonomously and do things which are slightly dangerous or slightly risky, where you prefer not to put a pilot in there in that scenario and put him or her into trouble. That's one aspect of the work that I also hope to talk about. The third aspect, which I will come back to in the end, is, again, goes back to the brain of the bee and says, how far can you push the perceptual capacities of a bee? I mean... Of a creature with a small brain. There's no doubt that insects will learn and bees will learn too, but when they learn things, do they learn them in a fairly, in a rote, automaton-like way, or can they be flexible about the way they think they learn things? Can they learn, for example, general rules from certain tasks that they've been asked to learn and apply them to novel situations? In other words, can you teach an old bee new tricks? That's the kind of thing we'd like to look at as the third part of the talk. So that's the general sort of outline of the talk. Now, when you take a close look at an insect eye, and as many of you know, insects have compound eyes as opposed to our eyes, which are called simple eyes. And the thing, a simple eye, of course, consists of a single lens that focuses light onto a large number of photoreceptors, typically 100 million in our case, in the retina. And so it's more or less like a camera eye. Whereas the compound eye consists of many, many little eyes. And each little eye is called an ommatidium. And this ommatidium consists of a small lens that focuses light onto a small group of light-sensitive cells, typically between 6 and 8 in number, photoreceptors. And each ommatidium looks in a slightly different direction in space. So in the case of a honeybee, you've got about 4,500 ommatidia in one eye and a similar number in the other eye. And this, together, this collection of 9,000 ommatidia is picking up a representation. It's sampling space. And what is nice is that within each ommatidium, you've got three different kinds of color receptors, for light-sensitive receptors. Just like we have trichromatic color vision, turns out honeybees also have trichromatic color vision, so they have three primary colors. And so each ommatidium is picking up a kind of a pointillistic representation, if you will, of the world. It's a panoramic pointillistic representation of the world that the compound eye is acquiring. So obviously the optics of the compound eye are a little bit different from the optics of our own eyes. But that by itself is not a great is not of great consequence. Much more fundamental difference between insect vision and our own vision comes about from the fact that the two eyes of an insect are actually very close together. Our eyes are fairly far apart. They're about 8 centimeters apart. And so we can do stereo vision quite easily. The reason why stereo vision works well with in our case is that because the eyes are fairly far apart, if I look at my finger with one eye and then with the other eye, go on, you can try it yourself, you'll find that the image of that finger is displaced between the two images in the retina, right? And what your brain is doing is it's actually measuring that displacement, or disparity as it's called, and by simple triangulation, it's working out how far away that finger is. Right? Does that make sense? Now, if you take these two eyes and move them progressively closer and closer together, that disparity gets smaller and smaller. And ultimately, when the two eyes are very close together, that disparity is close to zero because you virtually have the same viewpoint from both eyes. The eyes haven't shifted very much at all. So the stereo cues become very weak, very hard to measure if your eyes are very close together. It's like being it's almost like virtually like being a cyclops, rather than a two-eyed creature. So what do insects do? It turns out insects have overcome this problem by using an entirely different way to see the world in three dimensions. And we use that too, but insects use it a lot more. And the idea is that you don't try to use stereo at all. You simply do a much more active way of sensing the world in 3D. And this is by actually moving in the world and seeing how the image of the world changes in response to your motion. So the idea is very simple. Let's say you're flying along in a straight line or driving along a highway. You notice that the trees lining the highway are whizzing by you very rapidly. And this rapidity of image motion tells you that these objects are very close to you. On the other hand, distant objects like a distant hill or the clouds in the sky or the sun, those objects, the images of those objects don't move much at all as long as you're moving in a straight line, right? And that slowness of image motion tells you that those objects are very far away. So insects have learned to translate or interpret the speed of image motion as object distance. And that's how they disentangle the world into a 3D world. So they have to move in order to see the world in 3D. If they stop, the whole world collapses to a two-dimensional world. So they have to move in order to literally see. That's the way insect vision seems to work. Now, what I'd like to do is spend the next few slides describing to you some of the experiments we've done in our lab to gain this particular insights about how insects see the world in three dimensions and avoid colliding with objects and so on as they fly through it. Before I do that, has anyone in the audience actually trained bees? This is what I do for a living most of the time. I train honeybees. And it's actually lovely. You can do it in your backyard. It doesn't require any expense. So, by the way, this is Dr. Miriam Lehrer, who has taught me everything about bees. She is probably the world's expert in training bees. She's sadly passed away now. But when I joined the University of Zurich, she really was the person who sort of, you know, took me by the hand and really showed me how to do this. And here she is setting up a sugar water feeder outside the lab in the balcony in Zurich. And the hives are about 300 or 400 meters away. And if you set this up here on a summer morning, pretty soon bees will notice it. They'll come and land and taste the good sugar water. And then they'll go back home and report it through their dams, which we'll talk about later. Come back, and then they collect more and more recruits because they're signaling through the dams that there's some good stuff there. Okay, so what you do is then, once you've got a few bees coming out here, you suddenly increase the concentration of the sugar solution there. So the food tastes a lot better, much more sweet. That gets the bees a lot more excited. They go back home and dance more vigorously, recruit more bees, and pretty soon you've got quite a number of bees sort of accumulating here. And then you start to move this feeder step by step into the lab where you want to do your experiments. And of course the bees will follow. There's no problem there. But you've got to take account of the fact that this number is building up exponentially, and you don't want the whole hive to be visiting your lab, because typically you've got about 40,000 bees in a hive, and you don't want that. So what you do is, once you've got the feeder well and truly inside your lab, and about to enter your apparatus where you want to do your experiment, you place, in addition, another feeder here with weaker sugar solution. And that acts like a bit of a decoy. So what happens is that these new recruits, which have been sort of alerted by the dance, come in here and land at the most obvious target, which is this outside sugar solution now, which is much weaker than the inside one. And they say, this is a false alarm. This is not as good as it was cracked up to be. So they get disappointed and don't come back again. So it's only the bees that know the secret of where the good stuff is, the original bees, that keep coming, that know where to go. And they keep coming inside, and that's when you start your experiment. So you've got control over exactly how many bees you've got, or at least approximately how many bees you've got. It's a manageable number, typically about between 6 and 10. And then you can start your experiment. And they'll keep coming again and again. As long as there's no competition from outside food sources, which are much better, they will keep coming to your food source. And by the way, I should mention that these bees are coming to you of their own free will. They're not being forced or coerced in any way. It's just the food that you're offering them, right? So that's the only reason. Okay, so that's what you can. By the way, you can then color code these bees individually to keep track of individuals. And by the way, they do have individual personalities. Each bee is really very special. I mean, you can tell by its behavior after you know a particular bee exactly what it's going to do. They really are individual. I believe that they're not just, you know, creatures of one big collection. So you can color code them individually and follow their individual progress. If you're doing a training experiment, a learning experiment, you can keep track of how many times you rewarded them, and see how their learning curve develops and things like that. You can compare individuals and so on. By the way, before I forget to mention, all of the bees that come to us are, of course, females, because only the female worker bees that do all the foraging. So all of our work is done typically with females. It's only females who do all the hard work. The males don't do any work. They've got only one thing on their minds that certainly isn't foraging or hard work. So many, many years ago, we noticed that when we train bees, and sometimes we would train them to come through a hole in the window like this, for example. So we found that when bees flew through an aperture like this, a hole, they flew fairly precisely through the middle of the hole. And the question we asked ourselves is, how do they do that? How do they balance the distances to the left and right-hand rims so well when they fly down the middle, given the fact that they don't have stereo to measure the distances of these edges, right? So even if they had stereo, it really wouldn't work in this case, because you see, the right-hand rim of this hole is being viewed only by the right eye, and the left-hand rim is being viewed only by the left eye. So even if you had stereo, you couldn't really use it to solve this particular problem, right? So how do they do this? Well, we wondered whether they're doing something far simpler, which is to balance the speeds of motion of the two rims over the eye, the images of these two rims over the eye, as they fly through the aperture. If one rim appears to be moving faster than the other, you know you're too close to that rim, right? So you can position yourself to compensate for that. Well, do they do that? They can check that rather easily by training bees to come into a tunnel like this inside your lab. This is a sort of corridor-shaped tunnel with a sugar water feeder at the far end, which I haven't actually shown you here. And you line the inside of the tunnel with the visual texture, for example, vertical black and white stripes or some kind of visual texture. And then you place a video camera on top and film the trajectories of these bees as they're flying to the feeder. And lo and behold, what you find is the bees indeed fly down the middle of this tunnel, pretty much in the middle. These green bars denote the mean and standard deviation of several hundred flights analyzed in this way. There's a bit of slop, as you can see here. They're not precisely, you know, they're not dead in the middle, but hey, bees are only human. This is pretty good for a bee. This is not bad. However, what's interesting now is that if you take one of these walls and move it in the same direction as the bee, and you can do this because the walls are actually belts that are mounted on a sort of a spinning sort of two wheels that are conveyor belts. And of course, you've got perspex walls in the middle to make sure that there's no air currents that are affecting the flights of these bees. It's only the visual stimulus that affects them. So if you take one of these walls now and move it in the same direction as the flying bee, you find the bee flies a lot closer to the moving wall. So what's happening here is because the bee and the wall are moving in the same direction, the image velocity as seen by that left eye is lower, it's reduced. So the bee thinks that wall is much further away, so she moves closer to that wall to compensate. Right? Does that make sense? Okay, now the opposite thing happens if you move this wall in the opposite direction to the bee's flight. Now the bee flies a lot further away from that moving wall because now the bee is moving one way, the wall is moving the other way, so there's a huge image velocity seen by this eye, so the bee says, whoa, there's something dangerously close here. I better move away from that. And so that's what's happening here. So this simple technique actually tells us that bees actually negotiate narrow passages without bumping into the side walls, not by using complicated stereo mechanisms, but by actually balancing the optic flow, as it's called, on the two sides. And since we did this technique, published this paper, people have built actually robots, corridor sort of navigating robots that use the same principle, and they find that computationally it's a lot simpler to do it that way rather than to build stereo vision into a computer or into a robot. Also, it turns out that someone also did experiments with human beings after we did this work on bees and had a human being walking on a treadmill viewing a virtual reality setup where he could, it simulated walking along a corridor, and there you could manipulate the apparent speeds of the two walls, and they found that humans did the same thing too. So if you moved one wall in the virtual reality world, the person would veer off to one side or the other depending upon what you did to the wall. So even though we have stereo vision, subconsciously we're also using these optic flow cues to navigate quite often. So that's probably why you can do a lot of things with one eye, even though you don't have stereo. We're using motion cues a lot. This just shows you a view of our setup. This is one of our earlier setups at the Australian National University, where we do experiments with bees all year round, pretty much. We call it the All-Weather Bee Flight Facility, AWBFF. It's just a glorified greenhouse, which maintains 24 degrees during the day, 17 degrees in the evening throughout the year, so you can sort of, it simulates a balmy summer sort of situation to them all year round. And so they happily fly indoors here. The hives are actually placed against the walls, and they have an opening to the outside, so they can fly outdoors and take care of the nutritional requirements. We don't even need to feed them. They live a pretty normal life as far as the outdoors is concerned. But in some of these experimental hives, there's another hole opening to the inside, a small hole, through which we can train bees to actually come in and participate in whatever experiment we have planned for them. So we just do that by placing a sugar water feeder at the entrance that collects a few bees, and then we gradually move that feeder step by step, in this case into this tunnel here, and then off to the far end. And here we have these conveyor belts with polka dots on this thing at this time, and we've got the camera overhead filming these things. So it's very simple. Now, one of the other things we've been looking at relatively recently is how do insects land? Now, landing, as you know, is a tricky business. It's a fairly coordinated exercise you have to do because it's quite a dangerous thing. As you approach the ground, as every pilot will know, you will have to decelerate appropriately so that we're moving slow enough when you're close to the ground that you don't bang into the ground and hurt yourself, obviously, right? Not only that, you should not decelerate too rapidly because then you come to a sort of premature halt or hover above the ground, and that can be embarrassing. You've got to decide what to do next. So you want to orchestrate this landing. It's a very beautifully orchestrated, timed sort of maneuver, and we asked ourselves, how do flying insects do these nice landings? So to look at this, we train bees to come and actually land on a surface, a visually textured surface, just by placing a drop of sugar water on it. So the bee will come back again and again as long as the food is there. And from time to time, you shift the position of this drop so the bee doesn't know where to expect to find the drop. She has to come, look for it, and then do a landing. And then we film the landing. We're in three dimensions this time using two cameras, or there's several ways to do it. I won't worry about the details. And we look at how the landing actually occurs by measuring the following parameters of the landing trajectory. So as the bee comes into land, you can measure its forward speed, see how that changes with time as the bee lands, the descent speed, see how that changes as the bee lands, the height above the ground, and see how that decreases as the bee lands, and so on. And the most consistent and compelling finding to come out of these analyses, and I won't bore you with all the details, is that if you plot the horizontal flight speed, so this is the speed of the horizontal component of flight speed, if you see how that varies with the height above the ground, you get a fairly straight line. Here's four different examples where you have a fairly linear relationship between the speed of flight and the height above the ground. So the higher the bee, the faster it flies. The lower the bee, the slower it flies, right? So what this means is that, so obviously as it's coming down to the ground, it's flying slower and slower, but this linear relationship now tells you that it's actually keeping the image of the speed of the ground, speed of the image of the ground constant as it's coming into land. So let's say you land in an aircraft and the pilot brings you down, you look at the side through the window, you find that as you get closer and closer to the ground appears to be moving faster and faster, right? Now, if you don't allow the ground speed to get faster and faster, but you adjust your speed so the ground always appears to be moving at the same speed in your eye as you come down to land, then you'll automatically fly slower and slower as you come closer and closer to the ground. So it's a beautiful way to make a beautiful smooth touchdown, because when you're close to the ground, you're now moving at very low speed, so you don't burn your feet when you make contact. So it's a lovely way to land, because if you think about it, you don't need to know how high you are above the ground with this technique. You don't need to know how rapidly you're approaching the ground. All you have to do is to keep the image velocity constant, and that brings you down to the ground like a magical autopilot. And this is something we wouldn't have realized until we actually observed bees and filmed them and saw how they landed. So this is something we're trying to put into aircraft now to make them land autonomously. Okay, just go quickly into some of the applications-oriented aspect of our work. Of course, you'd like to have, to start with, to have a machine that has all-round panoramic vision, or as wide-angle as possible, to emulate the vision of an insect. Insects have lots of advantages by being able to look all around them. First of all, they can look for predators and prey everywhere around them. It also turns out that if you're using vision to rely on how you navigate, it helps a lot to be able to look all around you rather than look just in the front, for example, because you can tell by looking at the front and the back, for example, whether you're translating or rotating. So separating your motions and working out exactly what you're doing in space becomes a lot easier if you look all around you. So panoramic vision is actually a good thing to have if you're a flying creature. So we'd like to replicate panoramic vision into a vision system, and you can do that in several ways. You can, for example, build a compound eye, and that's something a lot of people are starting to do now, but we're not experts in that kind of optoelectronics, and we don't have that kind of technology know-how to do that. So we instead sort of copy or emulate panoramic vision by using a simple, dirty, off-the-shelf kind of trick where we take a standard video camera and point it at a specially shaped shiny surface, like a hubcap, you know. It's got a special shape, though. It's not quite a circle or a parabola. It's a special shape. And basically, you point it at the shiny shape, and then you can take this image and just digitally unwarp it, you know, make a cut here and stretch it out, and then this is what you get here. So what you see is virtually the whole world. Well, not entirely the whole world, but a good part of it. So going from here to here represents going from zero to all the way to 360 degrees in azimuth. And going from the top to the bottom is roughly a viewing angle going from about there to about there. So pretty much the whole world, although not all of it. There's a few blind zones in the system which you can overcome by doing other techniques, but I won't bore you with the details. So this is a panoramic vision system that we use quite routinely in our aircraft. So here's a test of this panoramic vision system. Before putting it onto a real aircraft, you want to make sure that your vision algorithm's actually working well. First of all, you want to test to see whether your understanding of how insects do it is actually correct, because you never know. And the only way to actually put it to a test is to actually put it into some kind of a semi-realistic system, at least, and test its performance to see how well it works. If it doesn't work well, you know you've done something wrong with your concepts. You don't understand the system very well, so you go back to the drawing board and design more experiments to find out exactly how the bees are doing it. So here's one simple test, and the idea is to put this vision system that I mentioned to you. So here's that shiny surface, which is being viewed by a camera here, and this is capturing an all-round view of the environment here. And this is made to navigate inside an artificial papier-mâché terrain that we've set up in the lab. It's sort of some simulation of maybe the Red Centre somewhere in the middle of Australia, or maybe terrain in Mars. It's just an unknown terrain. And this thing is actually meant to navigate on its own from a specified point A in the terrain to another specified point B in the terrain. Now, the interesting thing about this exercise is that the system does not have a map of the terrain. It has no knowledge of the topography or no knowledge of the map. It's meant to build it up as it goes along. 5 minutes to 25? Ooh. Ooh, we're going. Okay, so it's meant to go from there to there. Okay, and it's totally unknown terrain. And the principle is that it actually makes small steps along the way. At every point, it measures the image motion all around it. And based on the image motion, it works out how far away the surfaces are. And if they're dangerously close to colliding, it goes away from them, of course. And it's meant to steer down the middle of this ravine here and then get to this final finishing point here. It's also meant to fly at a fairly constant height above the ground, close to the ground, because, as you might have guessed, this is a project funded by the Air Force, and they would like to have aircraft follow the terrain, stay as close as possible to the ground to escape detection by enemy radar and things like that. Okay, so here's the system doing its thing. Starting point specified, finishing point specified, and back to the starting point. There we go. Now, as I said, this thing has no knowledge of its world. It's building it up as it goes along, and that's what it's doing. This is being played back, by the way, at 5 times the normal speed, so in reality it would be moving 5 times slower. When it has to come back, it did something that surprised us. It took a different route. So it was actually smarter than us. We always learn something new with these experiments. This is why we do these experiments. As it turns out, in retrospect, it turns out it is the right thing to do. But we didn't realize it. Okay, so once we're reasonably confident that these algorithms will work, or at least semi-work, when we put it onto an aircraft, because we don't want to put it onto an expensive aircraft and then crash the aircraft and then lose a lot of money. So we venture into putting it onto a real helicopter in this case. When I say real helicopter, I don't mean a real, real helicopter. I mean a model helicopter, about 1.5 meters by a fuselage length, and a similar rotor blade diameter. This is a sort of a high-end model helicopter, the Japanese helicopter that maybe wealthy Japanese business executive used to fly on weekends. Just for fun. So we take this helicopter and equip it with our own vision system, a special purpose design. So here's the camera looking down at the ground, flight computer. There are the inertial sensors, gyroscopes, and accelerometers, which measure the physical motion of the aircraft. And all those signals are actually, in this particular, this is a rather earlier version of our efforts. The signals are sent down to a ground station through the wireless, through a television camera link. And they're processed in the down station, and appropriate control commands are sent back via the radio control system that the pilot would normally have if he or she was actually flying the aircraft manually. Right. So the system is in closed loop with the ground via this wireless link, and is trying to fly autonomously or semi-autonomously through this entire closed loop. Okay, so here's just a block diagram of this cruise control system of the aircraft, which the details I won't bother you about. But here's a nice flight cruise test. So that's the helicopter. That's the ute on which the computer is based. And, of course, you have to fly drive the ute at about the same speed as the helicopter. Otherwise, you lose radio contact with it, and that's a disaster. That's an expensive exercise. and this thing is traveling at about 40 or 50 kilometers an hour. So it's actually quite an exciting exercise. And, of course, the engineer boys love doing this kind of thing. Now, this forward-looking camera is not really doing anything useful particularly. It's just giving us a few thrills. But there's another camera, a downward-looking camera, which is the sort of business end of the whole system. And what this is doing is it's measuring the optic flow, the image motion produced by the ground. and holding that at a constant level to keep the height of the aircraft at a constant height above the ground. So the idea is that the image velocity increases. It means you've gone down, you've lost altitude, so you pull back on the stick to increase your altitude. If the image velocity decreases, you mean you've gone too far, too high up, and you push down to bring it back down. So here's it's sort of the result of trying to get this aircraft trying to maintain a constant height above the ground as it's flying using just this vision system. So the advantage of using this vision system and not radar or sonar is that by you're not emitting any radiation, so you're not giving yourself away to the enemy, and also it's very light. I mean, video cameras now are so light and cheap and inexpensive, so you can put them on a small aircraft and help the soldier, for example, you know, in the battlefield. By the idea is the person would have a few of these things on his backpack, and he would launch them to go over a hill and see if there's any danger on the other side, rather than him going out there and then exposing himself to fire. Okay, so that's that. Now, if I may have, Ian, if I may, just 1 second, 5 minutes. I'll just, if you've got the patience, I'll just 5 minutes. I'll finish. This is going on to the last part of the talk, which is the cognitive part. How far can you push the perception of a creature with a tiny brain? Now, we all know that rats can learn to navigate through mazes and so on, and they've been that those studies have been really beaten to death. But no one's looked to see whether insects really can navigate through mazes. So here's an attempt to train an insect to go through a complicated labyrinth like this. Several boxes here. Some of these boxes have more than one exit, and the bee has to learn to find the correct exit, wherever there are multiple exits, to find the reward at the far end. Right? Now, in this case, we make the task a little bit easy for the bee by training it to follow a green tag that marks the correct exit wherever there's more than one exit. So it has to learn to follow the green tag. And you do that fairly simply by putting a green tag on a sugar water feeder and taking it step by step through the maze. You don't have to take it through the entire maze, just two or three steps, two or three boxes through the maze. And by then it's got the hang of, you know, the rule, which is to learn to follow the green tag. And then you can take, you know, to remove the feeder and put it at the far end, and it'll be just follow right through. And the performance is actually very good, and they can learn this thing in about a half a day. Here's a trained bee flying through one of these mazes. This happens very fast, so you'll have to be alert. So here she comes. Green tag. The green tag. Green tag. Green tag. Right. There she goes, and then finally she comes in. That's the destination where the reward is. So once you've trained bees to go through a maze like this, you can actually take them through any maze by just changing the arrangement of tags. And you can even make them go round and round in circles if you want to. But we'd never do that. I mean, we'd never do that. But that was simply following a green tag. Right? But here's something a little more challenging, a little more symbolic. Now here the idea is the bee is not simply dumbly following a green tag. They're given symbolic instructions. So whenever it enters one of these chambers and the back wall happens to be blue in color, it means the bee has to turn right. If the black wall is yellow in color, she has to turn left. So this is a symbolic direction sort of they've been giving to them, and they can learn this, surprisingly. And just as quickly and just as well, as a simple rule of just following a tag, which is always quite surprising for a bee. Unfortunately, I don't have a video to show you this, but that's the case. And of course, this final thing is the unmarked maze, which is the ultimate challenge. There's no cues or no hints anywhere. They have to learn the route, and they will learn that too. Not as well as the other ones, of course, because they've got cues in there. This just shows you the performance is not as good. But it's certainly better, significantly better than just randomly flying through the maze. And it turns out it's only these bees that actually learn the route through the maze. These other bees, which have been given these hints, never learn the route through the maze. They simply learn the dumb rule of following. Whereas it's only these bees that actually learn the route through the maze. And that I find is very human because, you know, when you're driving somewhere and your passenger is navigating, you never learn the route, do you? It's only when you have to learn it, you're forced to learn it yourself, that you actually learn. Remarkably human. Okay, here's one more example of something which we think is fairly human, but we find in bees too, cognitive thing. If you look at this image, and maybe some of you have seen this already, but those of you who haven't, what do you see here? You see this young lady here. I suppose you see these birds. You see these mountains in the distance. But if you look a little more carefully, maybe after a while, you might see these fingers here. And you might see this flute, and then eventually you might see the face here. Can everybody see it? Yeah? So once you've looked at this image and picked out all the camouflaged hidden objects, you'll never look at this image in the same way again. So every time you see this image, these hidden objects will just leap out at you. So our brains have got this amazing thing called top-down processing, where once you know what you're looking for, The brain has this wonderful capacity to reach down and pull out that signal, even though it's buried in noise, and extract the, you know, whatever there is to be extracted. So we wondered whether lowly bees also have something akin to top-down processing, the kind of thing that we have. So a very simple experiment here. We train bees to try to see if we can train bees to distinguish between two different kinds of camouflaged objects. So here's what happens. So you've got a textured background in each wall here, which is randomly textured, and this is what you see here as a background view. And in front of that, you have a textured object. So you have a textured ring over here, which you can barely see because it's camouflaged. And then here you have a textured disc, which again you can barely see because it's camouflaged. So you now try to train bees to distinguish between the ring and the disc by rewarding them on the ring, and they can't learn it. They simply cannot learn it. You can try to train them for 5 days. 5 days is a long time in the life of a bee. They simply cannot learn it. However, if you start by training them on uncamouflaged versions of the same shapes, right? So a ring, black ring versus black disc, they learn that task. And then if you give them the hidden camouflaged objects, they will immediately pick out the correct one. So it's as though once they've got this hint of what to expect, this prior knowledge allows them to seek out the hidden object and see it. Not only that, once they've learned this thing, these trained bees can be exposed to novel hidden objects, and they will learn to distinguish them with training. So you don't have to pre-train them with the uncamouflaged objects anymore. This, for example, is a horizontal bar. That's a vertical bar. So the same bees, once they've been trained to come this far, they don't need to be pre-trained on these bars. They just give it to them, train, they will learn it. So they've actually basically learned that this motion parallax that you get when you move from side to side, you know, it helps you disentangle or pull out the object against the background, and they've learned that that's a relevant cue to make these objects pop out or be visible, and they're now seeing the world in new ways, in ways that they would normally not learn. So that's quite not bad for a bee, I think, the way they can train a bee to look at new things. Okay, finish off. Okay, very last thing in. Associative recall. Now this, I don't know if this works for you, but if I look at this piece of this image, I can almost smell lemon. Okay. Associative recall is a very powerful thing. If you listen to a piece of music, for example, it could remind you of something you were doing a long time ago as a child. Or if you get a whiff of perfume or cologne, it might remind you of someone you knew a long time ago, but don't necessarily want to remember anymore. It's a very powerful phenomenon, right? So we wondered whether associative recall is there in bees too, and whether it can trigger sort of former memories. So here's the experiment. The idea is we want to see whether smells, scents can trigger memories of previously visited food sources, or flowers, for example. So here's the experiment. We train bees to go from a hive to visit a particular feeder. This is a sugar water feeder, which is laced with the scent of rose. So bees, individually marked bees, are trained to visit that feeder for a while. And then we take away that rose-scented feeder and place a different feeder, this time now carrying the scent of lemon, in a different location within the same landscape. And the same bees are now trained to visit that, okay, for a few times. And then we go back and forth. Whenever the feeder is over here, in this former position, it's got the scent of rose. Whenever it's over there, it's got the scent of lemon. Okay, we train them for a couple of days using this procedure. Then we go away, weekend, they can do whatever they want, we do whatever we want, and then come back on Monday morning. It's fairly quiet, early in the morning. So we place two dummy feeders now. These are just empty feeders. There's no sugar water, there's no scent. One feeder where the former rose scented feeder used to be, and one dummy feeder where the former lemon scented feeder used to be. And we simply blow these scents into the hive and see what happens. So if you now blow rose scent into the hive, it's very quiet in the morning, there's hardly any bee traffic. But the moment you blow this rose scent into the hive, these bees appear, and most of them visit or look for food at the former rose-scented feeder. Whereas if you blow lemon-scented thing, most of the bees now visit the same bees now go to lemon-scented feeder. So the interesting thing here is that there's no scent now anymore at the targets. The scent that we're injecting in the hive is simply triggering these memories. It's almost like a deja vu in these bees, and that's causing them to go and actually seek out these sources again. So they do seem to have this complex associative recall that we seem to have. So just a glimpse of, you know, cognitive capacities in bees, and I really don't want to go any further, but I'd like to thank my colleagues, Dr. Zheng Xiaowu, who's for many, many, many years has, you know, collaborated with me and spearheaded the effort on working with honeybees, Judith Reinhardt, who did those lovely experiments on associative scent recall that I just described, Pinar Letzkus, whose work I couldn't have a chance to describe, but she finds that bees are right antennae. Just like we are right-eyed and most of us are right-handed, bees also are handed in their behavior. So they see better with their right eyes, they learn things better with their right eyes, they learn smells better with their right antennae. Javan Chal, who spearheaded the robotics effort until recently, has moved to DSTU in Adelaide now. Dean Sokol, who is our a pilot and mechatronics engineer, and Saul Thurgood, who is our computer engineer. So, thank you very much.
So, thank you very much, Sharini.
Sorry for going over.
I think we would listen to all day. At least I would have anyway. Okay, we've got time for... We've got 5 minutes for questions. If we've got a roving microphone. We need to use the microphone. So we've got a hand up here, first one. Just keep your questions brief if you can, and we get more through.
A quick comment that we have racism in the human realm with the obvious meaning known by all. Perhaps a wordsmith should come up for a word that describes the intellectual arrogance we apply to the animal kingdom that carries the same weight as racism. But anyway, is smell the dominant sense? I mean, you've described sight, but is smell the dominant sense in birds?
Smell, it seems to work, at least at close range, smell seems to be the most powerful cue. From afar, bees will certainly learn. I didn't have time to talk about all that. Bees will use information on the distance of the food source and the direction in which to fly to it. All that's given from the dance. So that a new recruit will use that information imparted by another bee to get close enough to the food source. And then, of course, when it gets close enough, if it's got a sample of nectar from the other bee, which also happens, they give them scent samples, it can home in using the scent when it's close enough to the actual food source. And then an experienced bee that learns a particular food, a particular plant, will learn to recognize the color of the flowers. Color learning is very important to them. Also the shape of the flowers. So they will learn things. They can also learn very abstract things like symmetry versus asymmetry. You can train bees to learn sort of fairly abstract sort of concepts like that. But at close range, smell is pretty important, to answer your question.
Question middle here.
My understanding of your visual description is that the human eye, each human eye processes one linear image and then arrives at a stereo overlap, and that the bee has 4,500 receptors in each eye, and it is processing 9,000 receptor images through its brain constantly.
Yes.
To arrive at one image. And their brains are doing it in a much smaller...
Yeah. I mean, the big challenge with all visual systems, I guess, is, you know, you've got this, you're being bombarded with the sensory information that you, in our case, we've got 100 million receptors in each eye, a lot of information going in, and the brain has to be very selective and very good at picking out what is relevant and discarding things that are not relevant. And this is, again, a big challenge for a machine vision expert. So they really don't know how the brain does it, and they're still fighting with, algorithms that will do that job. It's not easy. Yeah, absolutely.
Question up the back.
You did say that the bees that you trained had different personalities. Could you just describe that a little bit?
Oh, well, you know, especially in these training with Y mazes and so on, where they have two choices and you're trying to train them to pick the correct stimulus, you find certain bees that will shoot through. They won't linger in that decision chamber. They will just make a very quick decision and shoot through. Whereas, and sometimes get it right, sometimes get it wrong. But there are other bees that will hesitate. They'll vacillate, you know, for what seems like an eternity between the two choices, never make up their mind. In fact, when I was first training bees, my wife, Jessie, was helping me train them, and we were doing this, and there was one particular bee which would spend forever trying to make a decision. And ultimately, when it made a decision, it was usually the wrong one. So my wife called it Srini. So they really have individual personalities.
It's probably the last question up here, I think.
Yeah. My question relates to that, I think. I was going to ask you what you made of the bees that actually get it wrong with the scent test.
That's a good point. I don't know. There's always a few bees that... The percentage of bees that get it wrong seems to depend upon the complexity of the test. If it's a simple test like learning colors, bees will learn to discriminate two colors, blue versus green, very well. And so 95% of the bees will get it right. If it's a more complicated test like going through, for example, an unmarked labyrinth or something much more complex like the associative recall that you mentioned, there's the success rate is not that big. And It's a good question. What is different about those bees that get it wrong? We really don't know. And whether is it always the same bees that get it wrong? Or is it, you know, just every bee making an error? We don't know. It'll be a very interesting question. We'll have to do a detailed analysis. But I think there certainly are bees that are good learners as opposed to bees that are not so good learners. And it's not clear whether it's because of differential experiences before, you know, in the environment, or whether there's something genetic in there too. Because as you know, these bees could come from different fathers. Because when the queen bee goes and mates, she mates with several different males, and she carries that sperm, and she can produce offspring that are full sisters or half sisters, depending upon whether they come from the same father or different fathers. There could be a genetic component to this behavior too.
Okay, well, we're out of time. We need to stick to time pretty tightly. That's a good point to finish on, right in the middle of the nature versus nurture debate.
Yes.
And that bees maybe help us through that as well, which would be even more marvelous. So we've been privileged to have a really fantastic talk today. If you're interested in other aspects of brain function, the next talk in half an hour's time at the Radford Auditorium is Natasha Mitchell, the host of the ABC's All in the Mind program. She's talking about, I think, You Are Not Your Brain Scan or something like that, which will be equally fascinating. But anyway, for now, thank you, Shireni, for a wonderful talk. And just look after your bees, please.
Yeah. Thank you.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.